These are African rhythms, passed down to us through ancient spirits. Feel the spirit, a unifying force. Come on, move with the spirit. Stand up, clap your hands. Move with the rhythms, get down.
From WSNC 90.5 FM, a broadcasting service and NPR affiliate of Winston-Salem State University, welcome to Africa World Now Project. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. Today, we are worth fighting for with Dr. Josh Myers. Africa World Now Project is next. I would like to be clear at the outset. The question of the survival of black colleges and universities is actually a very problematic inquiry. This is no different a sentiment given the current pandemic. What do I mean? It is a question loaded with the insidious racialized undertones of the question of what to do with the Negro and Negro labor as W.E.B. Du Bois and others eloquently explored through thought and action. When predominantly white institutions waver in the context of global economic shock due to inherent deficiencies in racial capitalism, the survival of PWIs is not up for debate. Moreover, it highlights the internalization of racialized ideological propensities as the question is debated primarily by folk within the black community. The colonized ideological impulses that drive the philosophy of education as it relates to Africana people filter into and arrest the imagination of communities who attach to survivalist projects that suggest the only way out is to be cogs in a machine designed to overwork, underpay, and discard its human remains. The survival of black colleges and universities as being intimately tied to the economic structures and cultural worldview of Western imperial systems of knowledge production is in fact a contradiction itself. Just as the imposition of the nation-state on Africana communities through colonial and imperial projects produced contradictions of the colonized mind. Black colleges and universities are highly diverse institutions, some of the most diverse in the world, in fact. The ancient practices rooted in African and African-descended peoples congregating in common space, whether forced or voluntary, has produced much of the world's most innovative thoughts and practices that range across all disciplines. In short, hashtag HBCUs work. This is despite working within constraints that if one simply scratches the surface of explanations are due to manufactured budget and other non-monetary constraints, as well as undue institutional, professional, and academic demand. Moreover, this is all wrapped within another layer of insidious structures run by, quite frankly, a Commodore class of managerial black elite and wannabe elite who have been trained in the best traditions of plantation philosophical practices that arrest the radical imagination of its students and faculty who are invested in nurturing a critical consciousness, the ability to think creatively and find ways to allow HBCUs to be what they are destined to be, black universities. We have covered this particular concept of black universities and its long historical processes, including and up to the conferences held at Howard University. You could just review the archive. If allowed the unfettered freedom to develop its most potent substance, the intellectual capital of some of the world's most brilliant minds that are fed by the river of genealogies that run through the ancestral and historical memories of its students, fragments of memories of the Library of Alexandria, the temple complexes throughout Kemet and Nubia, Izitunia, founded in 732, Al-Kawrawiyyin, founded in 859 AD in Morocco, the universities at Timbuktu in the 12th century, Foray Bay College in Sierra Leone, 1827, University of Cape Coast in South Africa, founded in 1829, to name a few. Note, Cheney University in Pennsylvania is the oldest HBCU in the U.S., founded in 1837. The answers to the world's most pressing issues must flow through HBCUs. Questions around what to do with disproportionate impacts of pandemics, economy, etc. must be analyzed by the very communities who are impacted. There is no debate the progenitors to the modern university, Western or otherwise, have origins in Africa. The questions posed by Du Bois that challenge Black institutions delivered in various speeches from 1906, The Hampton Idea, to his 1960, Whither Now and Why, should serve as the frame through which we look, through which we will look today. In Whether Now and Why, Du Bois argues that the Negro race has got to impress upon its children certain fundamental facts. The normal human being must work and work regularly.
And work regularly to supply his wants, such legitimate wants as food and clothes and shelter. In addition, there must be creative activities, such as we understand under art and literature. And then there must be systematic recreation for health, for normal satisfying of the sexual instinct, for social contact, for sympathy, friendship, love, and sacrifice. In this matter of life vocation, we Negroes have got to inculcate in the minds of our children many objects to which white America today is not only opposed, but bitterly fights. Why should a man be a physician? Not simply to cure disease and treat accidents, but to prevent disease and protect health. Today, most physicians, white and black, have no time for this. This is the object of social medicine and is practiced in most of Europe, both Western and Eastern, and in China. While the American Medical Association fights with huge funds every effort to bring government-supported social medicine to the service of the people. Why should a man study law but to see that justice is done? And yet the chief service and huge pay of lawyers today in America is to guide wealthy and powerful corporations in breaking the law and in putting on the statute books laws which discriminate against the poor. Our jails are bursting with prisoners who have no one to defend them, even when they have committed no crime.
Black institutions must deal with questions around radical imagination, intellectual capital moving away from the fallacy of obtaining access to the plantation capital that PWIs were built upon. HBCUs will never be players in this game. At most, eager bystanders are fourth-string reserves on the threshold of being cut, demonstrating a conformability in its inability to navigate out of its liminal existence. HBCUs must substantively align with institutions throughout the Global South, rooting its practice in constant processes of decolonization, the advancement and evolution of Africana indigenous knowledge systems. We must move the intellectual boundaries of HBCU knowledge production beyond limited and arrested expectations. Again, Du Bois brings into sharp clarity a critique of Black education and charge for Black institutions setting the task for future generations. In an article in 1902 printed in The Atlantic, which also becomes a chapter in Souls of Black Folk in 1903 titled Of the Training of Black Men, that I argue today can be applied across the gender principle, he writes, "The tendency is here, born of slavery and quickened to renewed life by the crazy imperialism of the day, to regard human beings as among the material resources of a land to be trained with an eye single to future dividends. Race prejudice, which keep brown and black men in their places, we are coming to regard as useful allies with such a theory. And above all, we daily hear that an education that encourages aspiration, that sets the loftiest of ideas and seeks as an end, culture and character, rather than breadwinning, is the privilege of white men and the danger and disillusion of black. The danger and disillusion of black, brown, and poor folk, as Du Bois warned, is the substance upon which institutions have inculcated and the structures that educate generations of students, is summed up in one question parents ask, but in reality are perpetuating the colonializing ideological impulses that drive the philosophy of education as it relates to Africana peoples around the world. What are you going to do with that degree in Africana studies? In art, literature, history? Or they demand you go to school to get a job? The sad reality is many of those who are integrated in HBCUs, who are charged with the noble task of guiding the minds of young folk, are the primary perpetrators of these colonizing limited ideological impulses. We no longer live in that space. That is to simply get a job. Sidney Wilhelm, Henry Herbert Harrison, C.L.R. James, Oliver Cox, James Boggs, Earl Ofori Hutchinson, and others argued this since the 1940s. The global racialist capitalist system does not have enough room to accommodate all peoples clamoring for, quote, jobs, unquote. The question still stands, to which we are ancestrally and historically bound to answer today. Whither now and why? Today, Dr. Josh Myers will explore these themes and more in a talk he gave at Winston-Salem State University, centered around the publication of his We Are Worth Fighting For, A History of the Howard University Student Protest of 1989. He engaged this history in relationship to the form and function of HBCUs. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descended communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Cooperation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, and Ghana, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Enjoy the program.
Good afternoon, evening.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for being here. I know at Howard University, when it rains, nobody comes outside. So this is a great sight to see. Hopefully, some of what I say will resonate. I first want to thank Dr. James Pope, and the OIP and the Africana Studies Program. For the invitation. With this type of book, it's extremely important for me to visit HBCUs and think with HBCU people because we have to ensure their preservation. And this book is right in that tradition of preservation. It may be hard for us who are younger to imagine a moment where people really seriously discuss the elimination of HBCUs. But it should be less harder for us to imagine a moment where people seriously have been considering changing their mission and their purpose, because we're in that moment right now. And this is a book that I hope will contribute to that conversation and move us to a place where we can actually fulfill the great potential that HBCUs have. One of the things that struck me when I saw the flyer were these two words, form and function. And so it kind of inspired me to do some writing. One of the things that I'm stricken with is hypergraphia. I can't write enough to satisfy myself. So last night, as I was coming down, I decided, let me just put some stuff on the page and see what happens. And maybe, you know, reading a little bit from what I've written will kind of open the space up for us to have a real discussion, not just a celebration of a book, but a real discussion about the form and function of HBCUs. So I'm going to start reading from what I've written, and hopefully you all can connect and resonate with some of my thoughts here. When I think of the words form and function, my mind first goes to the work of Anyaoku Love, a scholar of John Coltrane, and black musics writ large, who often repeated the dictum from Kalamu Yassalam, the great critical black arts movement thinker who was for a long time based in New Orleans. who often repeated this dictum. He said, form follows function. Form follows function. So when we think of form, we must think beyond the rigid category, this rigid category, or a structure that belies the dynamism of improvisation inherent to our meaning making. But form is also not nothingness. It is not nothingness. It follows function, and that shifts constantly. It is a thing that is discernible, but it is not static. So form follows function. And then I am reminded of a few weeks ago when the filmmaker Haile Gerima, during his critical readings series, evoked form to distinguish a jazz tradition in the work of the novelist Tony Cade Bambara. A tradition, he reminds us, has to be understood as marking not only her work in literature, but in film. Jazz then becomes a beautiful lens through which to understand Black life, its improvisatory nature, its ensemble. The way that it resolves itself, how it never ends, how each round goes higher and higher. And I didn't think about it, but I should have played an example of what I mean, because it's good to hear the music. One of my mentors, Acklin Lynch, always reminds me to tell students that they have to listen to the music before they can really understand the words that I'm talking about. I'm saying that you have to hear it for yourself. But every round goes higher and higher, but also lower too. If jazz is a form, it is one accessible to us because it is always around us. It is us. Its function then is to reveal us to ourselves. That's why jazz is so powerful. It was the one thing for, not the one thing, but one of many things, one of few things I should say, that we could use to show us ourselves, to ourselves, right? That is how I want to write history. Not as a narration of a dead past, perhaps with lessons, but ultimately for academic consumption. Not as a record of achievement to prove Black belonging to a fleeting and mythical American democratic project. No, for us. For us, those who practice Black study, history is mirror and memory. And we have to render it in a particular form to play this particular function. It is hard work, and we fail every day. But as we think about questions of failure, it is not necessary to think and dwell on the failure. What is necessary is to dwell on what the actual objective was. Because if we forget that and we focus on failure, we may not try it. And we have to keep this work going. As we think about Black History Month, we have to also think about what philosophies of history, what historiographical traditions will serve this grand function. As histories exclude and erase, but perhaps most dangerously, incorporate and reimagine Black life, we will need to think through form and function as we understand our past. It is urgent. And so with this book, you know, I kind of played with form. It is not, or I hope it is not, I didn't intend for it to be a kind of staid history. I wanted it to be a history that lives, that has life, that moves us, that takes us to a place, right? And so as I thought about form and function, then I started to think about another sort of play on the word function. And that, of course, is from W.E.B. Du Bois. It's one of my favorite pictures of him, just straight chilling. Because the image of him that we all often have is this rigorous scholar who devoted every moment of his waking life to thinking and studying, which he did, but sometimes you just gotta chill. In the wake of thinking about everything that's happening in our communities and out in our world, you know, Du Bois is just chilling. But you also see him as an elder, almost like, I've done my work. He's looking out at us, he's like, okay, I'm chilling now, what y'all gonna do? And I take that responsibility to enliven and incorporate Du Bois in everything that I do, not because he was a unique or an exceptional figure, but because he represented so many of our other strands and traditions that came out of his life. Look at the dates of his life, in fact. Date of birth of 1868, 3 years after the abolition of enslavement. 1963, literally the day before the March on Washington, he makes his transition. That's a lot of time, but also a lot of time in the deeper sense of
engaging what black people were doing, right? 95 years, those 95 years? I was telling the class earlier that I lectured in that, you know, people look at that moment as like a gap, like nothing happened, right? So we kind of jumped from Frederick Douglass to Martin Luther King. Like, what about these 100 years? What was happening in black America? Du Bois had his finger on that pulse, right? And so from about 1908, I think his first one, to about 1961, every now and then Du Bois would give a commencement speech at an HBCU. 1933, a few years after a major fight at his alma mater at Fisk University. This is an important fight. You want to read about it. There's a book called The New Negro on Campus by Raymond Walters. I would not recommend his larger work because he was a conservative, is a conservative and a racist. But this particular book, for whatever reason, sought to study the New Negro period at HBCUs. And it's a very interesting chapter on Howard, interesting chapter on Fisk and Hampton. You know, Du Bois comes down and says, what are you doing? What, like, you know, he graduates from Fisk in the 1880s. He comes later in the 1920s and is like, wow, what are y'all doing? I mean, a deeply conservative moment at a time when black people across the world are like raising and pushing. I mean, this is what we call the New Negro Movement, or what was called, or sorry, what we call the Harlem Renaissance, but what was then called the New Negro Movement, right? It's the emergence of, you know, Garveyism, Pan-African movement. So many things are happening across the world, and HBCUs weren't doing anything, and in fact, were preventing their students from participating in much of this stuff. And it creates this groundswell of protest activity at places like Howard, at Hampton, and at Fisk. So it's a fascinating text. A few years after that, Du Bois comes back to Fisk, and he gives a talk back on this notion of function called The Field and Function of the American Negro College. That's my little photograph of the original typescript that I saw when I visited his papers in the summer of 2018 at University of Massachusetts Amherst. But this is a text that has been with me for a very long time. And I think it's a text that we could use, I don't want to use the word blueprint, but as a guide, as inspiration for how we think about HBCUs. So I'm going to read a little bit of what I think about, from this text. Form and Function recalls most prominently the 1933 commencement speech that W.E.B. Du Bois gave in 1930, gave at his alma mater, Fisk University. Which he titled The Field and Function of the American Negro College. It was a clarion call for a black university. Years before that demand became the guiding one for students at places like Howard University in the late 1960s, a call that was repeated by the students in 1989, a call repeated today. In that speech, Du Bois maintained that the, quote, American Negro problem is and must be the center of the Negro university. Like all universities do for their constituent populations, quote, the black university begins with Negroes. It uses that variety of the English idiom which they understand, and above all, it is founded, or it should be founded, on a knowledge of the history of their people in Africa and in the United States and their present condition, end quote. And for Du Bois, this was not to be some simplistic notion of black universities gesturing to serving the community. He was after something much deeper than how certain neoliberal-minded university leaders defined their role in the lives of black communities. He was after something that was epistemological, meaning we had to do knowledge differently to truly transform how we understand the meaning of black life. Later in the speech, Du Bois asserted that, quote, starting with the present condition, using the facts and the knowledge of the present situation of American Negroes, the Negro University expands toward the possession and the conquest of all knowledge. It stems from a beginning of the history of the Negro in America and in Africa to interpret all history. From the beginning of social development among Negro slaves and the freedom in American and Negro tribes and kingdoms in Africa, to interpret and understand the social development of all mankind in all ages. It seeks to reach modern science of matter and life, from the surroundings and habits and attitudes of American Negroes and thus lead up to the understanding of life and matter in the universe. End quote. History, social sciences, biological sciences all have African foundations. You have to study them. And the place to study them are HBCUs. Question is, why are we doing that? And they're here being everywhere, right? Not Winston-Salem, not just Winston-Salem, not just Howard, but all HBCUs start from the foundation of Western knowledge. Why is that? This seems to be an intellectual agenda for HBCUs then and now. What else could be our reason for existing? This function now must lead to new forms, university traditions that have never existed before in the modern world. We cannot afford to replicate the models we have been given. They will not work for us. They are not even working for the systems of neoliberal capitalism that they are meant to uphold. As Vincent Harding wrote in 1970, dark, dying copies of whiteness are no longer needed. New models must carry the day. The center cannot hold. So this book, The Voices, The Education of Black People, 10 critiques are the 10 commencement speeches that he gives over those 6 decades on HBCU campuses. So the one that I think is perhaps the guide, the field and function of the American Negro College. In the throes of the Great Depression, Du Bois actually did put together a model. Recounting this in his last autobiography, A Soliloquy on Viewing My Life in the Last Decade of Its First Century, probably my favorite of the autobiographies. He had like 4. In a chapter called New Deal for Negroes, he imagines a beginning to how black universities might take up this work. From his base at Atlanta University, he believed that the land-grant institutions could pioneer a cooperative project to study the social conditions of black people. But it was not to be a mere snapshot. His vision was that of a, quote, total study of a complete situation. A total study of a complete situation. Continuously photographed and re-photographed, measured and remeasured, so that our knowledge of the vast and momentous social experiment in race relations now taking place in the United States would attain a completeness and authority that would be unquestioned and unquestionable and available in the post-war world, which will surely need this sort of information. End quote. Echoing beliefs he had articulated over 40 years earlier, Du Bois understood the Negro problem as a method for demonstrating whether or not American social science was up to the task of becoming a useful intellectual project at all. We can say now, almost 80 years later, that it has not. And HBCUs have faltered by following the dominant models handed to them instead of taking up the intellectual project that Du Bois had imagined. Even in his own time, HBCUs demonstrated that despite their interest, they could not follow through on this and other initiatives Du Bois had developed. When he was unceremoniously retired against his will by Atlanta University following the death of John Hope, the project died. In the years after, HBCUs, in most cases, were beholden in forms unbefitting what could have been a different and more relevant function. In other cases, they simply lacked the political will. The question I ask, what of us? So this is my text, We Are Worth Fighting For, a history of the Howard University student protest of 1989. And so we're gonna talk a little bit about what happened, and then we're gonna talk a little bit about what it did. In 1989, what Howard students faced was a world undergoing monumental shifts, a world in deep flux. In the beginning of that year, about 31 years to the day, meaning to this day, the university had approached a shaper of that world by the name of Lee Atwater, the racist campaign strategist and then Republican National Committee chairman, to join its board of trustees. Lee Atwater was a mercenary, meaning he was someone that was hired to do whatever it took to win.
We are listening to a talk that Dr. Josh Myers gave at Winston-Salem State University. Josh Myers is an assistant professor of Africana Studies in the Department of Afro-American Studies at Howard University, and author of We Are Worth Fighting For, A History of the Howard University Student Protest of 1989, and member of the Africa World Now Project Collective. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, and Ghana, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Continue to enjoy the program.
Meaning he was someone that was hired to do whatever it took to win. And in many cases, his politics were less important than the tactics to him. And so for him, racism was just an available tactic. It was an available strategy. And in 1988, when Michael Dukakis and George H.W. Bush were running for president, and Bush was losing, in the polls. Nobody took him seriously. Atwater found a weakness, and the weakness was that Dukakis had overseen a liberal project of prison release programs. And that particular project was called into question when one such prisoner by the name of William Wharton committed a crime, a vicious crime, when he was out on release. They then used that to sort of attack Michael Dukakis as soft on crime. After all, you oversaw this particular project that allowed a murderer to escape. And when he escaped, he committed yet another crime. Despite the fact that both Republicans and Democrats had been part of these sort of carceral strategies that were then taking place, the strategy was not necessarily about crime, it was about blackness. They then took William Wharton's image and they broadcasted it on campaign messages to brand Michael Dukakis, not just as soft on crime, but soft on black people. With that image, and this is a direct quote, Lee Atwater said that Willie, and they called him Willie to kind of dehumanize him, because he never actually called himself Willie, right? He said Willie Wharton has now become Michael Dukakis' target. Immediately, the election shifted, and George H.W. Bush won. And because we got George H.W. Bush, we got his son, George W. Bush, and all that ensued at that particular moment, right? Y'all don't remember that. Election in 2000. Permanent war. He ushers us into permanent war, right? But had his father not won, there's no way that George W. Bush was going to sniff the White House, right? And George H.W. Bush doesn't sniff the White House without Lee Atwater using this racist campaign. So this is the guy that Howard wants to be on their board of trustees? What is wrong with Howard? That was the question that these students asked. What is wrong with our administration? What are y'all doing? These students were shaped by alternative worlds. Hip-hop. The anti-apartheid movement. And so they could not and would not accept white supremacy as the price for their university stability. If Atwater could be a member of the board of trustees, what meaning could the education at Howard actually have? How could they take seriously the other decisions that the university would make given its relationship to the right-wing politics? As their placards during the protest read, it was not the man Atwater, it was the ideology. Black students at Howard were resisting neoliberalism at a particular moment of its emergence within the norms and logics of the American university system of management. Meaning, universities are not only complicit, they shape neoliberalism, the notion that the market is the best way to provide resources to human beings. Not the state, but the market. Which is why y'all have are going to graduate with student loan debt, because student loan companies see you as an additional investment that's going to be returned when the people that also pay for your education recruit you on campus to get a job. So you become almost a pawn in the game between two corporate entities who want you to be educated so that you can pay them back, literally. Not so you can develop as a human being. That's not a question. Can you pay this loan back? That's what we mean when we say neoliberalism, this market orientation to reality. And Googie Watanabe calls it market fundamentalism. Our lives are always shaped by market activity, right? And it almost denies that you know, people who live in the markets or who work in these markets are actually humans. Well, that shouldn't be foreign to African people because we came here as capital. So we live in a moment where that's been hyper-rationalized. So some of us even accept that as the price too. Yeah, well, I gotta market myself. Gotta brand myself. Like, really? You don't use that word particularly? Brand? Okay. And so this was a moment in the late 80s where that was just becoming, that was just coming into focus. For those who may not, well, none of y'all were here, but for those who were here, none of the students were here, probably remember when the Democratic Party made that shift, the Democratic Leadership Council in 1988. They said, we can't win on a traditional liberal politics, so we're going to move to the center. Because one thing that we have to do is compete. That's how we ended up with William Jefferson Clinton, as opposed to an actual liberal. And so, Black students were resisting this as it was happening, and it's a really important story to tell, because I don't know if people realize that nobody accepted Reaganism like easily. Like, Black people resisted that. And I think as we talk about the 2020 election, people that want to really understand the evolution of American politics have to study two political campaigns, 1984's Jesse Jackson presidential run, 1988's Jesse Jackson presidential run. I know what you may think about Jesse Jackson now, but in 1984 and 88, he actually built a political movement to resist Ronald Reagan. And he got people from all walks of life in the Black community, right? There's ideological diversity within the Black community, but everybody worked for Jesse Jackson. It's really important for us to study that. And Black youth supported him almost 100%. You can imagine Jesse Jackson in the rap video, you know, talking about Africa. That's what the environment was. Jesse Jackson knew how to appeal because he actually had ideas that resonated with the masses of our people. It wasn't pandering, in other words. In resisting this pivot, these students also called by the end of the 80s, they called for what we now call Afrocentricity. They called for an Afrocentric university. So when these students called for an Afrocentric university, the university responded by calling the cops. Literally. And herein lies the contradiction, the tension that had always existed at Howard, at HBCUs, and in the Black world. Our freedom dreams are criminal to a system that needs Black people to be unfree, contained, dominated, in order for it to be what it must be. So when a Harvard or University of Michigan required federal dollars, connections to the corporate machine that determined their form and function, these same power structures saw HBCUs as places that required release. And that's literally, we talk about the amount of violence that happened, state violence, police violence that happened at HBCUs during this period. Control these new groups. Then when the police left, they sent the CIA to recruit. Like, this ain't a conspiracy theory. Like, this is happening, right? It sounds like a conspiracy theory. They sent the NSA to recruit, right? Literally have police among us, right? And so that was almost the price for staying open during this era. And so the students resisted all of that. The students at Howard knew that they were risking everything. And it calls for us to consider what we are willing to risk. When they first heard about Atwater, a group called Black Near Force knew that they needed to raise their voices. Founded in 1988 by Ras Baraka, who was the current mayor of Newark, New Jersey. He's also the son of Amiri and Amini Baraka. Black Near Force was a formation that adapted various elements of the Black radical tradition, particularly the 60s iteration of this freedom struggle. They believed in Martin Luther King's vision of a world universe, but supplemented with the radical self-determination of the Black Panther Party, the military and personal discipline of the Nation of Islam. Above all, they were inspired by conscious rap and saw a connection to Africa through both history and the current struggles on the continent. Every Friday night, they created what Fred Moten and Stefano Hardy might call an undercommons, meeting in Douglas Hall at a particular time, 7:30, where most students were gearing up to party. They managed to build a base of students who devoted that moment to study and debate to questions of Black liberation, but some party right after them. Baraka was a charismatic figure, a great orator who felt that the hip-hop generation was not living up to his parents' example. Black Neo-Force was a response to the lack of organization on Howard's campus that would speak to both the nationalist and radical impulses of the Black freedom struggle, while also maintaining an awareness that Black students at Howard needed a language of struggle that spoke to first-generation ghetto experiences. It's a unique part of its history that Howard has this almost overwhelming population of Black students who came from urban America that was being decimated by the drug crisis. And so they came with that experience. And so a group that couldn't speak to that would not resonate. It's a lesson in organizing here, right? That you have to literally speak the language of the people that you want to organize and bring them to wherever you need to bring them. So one way that they kind of resonated with these students, and by any definition, the students who came, they immediately joined gangs on campus. And it's really hard for us to imagine that, because clearly, the whole motif that college students are gangsters, right? It wasn't true in the 1980s, right? Because one thing that you had to do was survive D.C. If you had no clique, you was out of luck living in D.C. So the Howard students literally formed cliques. And what they did with Black Neo-Force is they organized that energy and they became a paramilitary organization. So this is a photo of them literally drilling on Howard University's campus, on the yard. It's very Nation of Islam. It's very Black Panther Party. But it's also 1980s Black youth culture. They're listening to Public Enemy, Boogie Down Productions. They're listening to Rakim. They're engaging all of these traditions. And this is how it came out. Okay? And as they're doing this, they're also studying, right? They're thinking. It was an eclectic mix, but it worked. They made connections to Sister Soldier, as well as to the rap group Public Enemy. They hosted forums with Anthony Browder, Yosef Benyakinen, Francis Press Welsing. They worked in the community with school children and also managed to adopt ideals of self-discipline in the face of the normal challenges and temptations that college students encounter. They did not, however, participate in direct action. That was not on the table when this organization was founded. We're not going to protest people that don't want us. Right? We're not going to do sit-ins. We're not going to do the traditional things, right? But that all changed. It changed when Atwater was appointed. In the month between the initial news and the protest, members of Black Neo-Force, which had marginal membership, every Howard student was going to wear black and drill on the yard. Like, they only had maybe at most 75 members. But they used that to organize the entire campus body, which is another lesson in organizing that this book tells. How do you get, Greek letter organizations to work with groups like this? Like, how do you do that? How do you get, organizations that are less concerned, with questions of the movement to work with groups like this? And so they organized, they got the campus chapter of the NAACP, they got the traditional civil rights groups, they got the social and cultural groups, the affinity groups, and they came together as a unit. They developed a list of demands that included issues such as housing and financial aid, but also for the creation of a graduate program in African American studies, as well as a community service requirement for graduation. But the university was not hearing them. They dismissed the concerns as above their heads. So the new coalition decided to take action to have their voices heard, and it would change Howard University. On March 3rd, 1989, the students took over the university's charter day services, displacing its honoree, Bill Cosby, who was thought to have come to Howard with a check in hand. He was overshadowed by Black Neo-Force's newly appointed president, April R. Silver. And this is her right in the middle with the Howard sweatshirt speaking. She was a quiet student from Los Angeles who had New York roots. She was ushered to the stage during Charter Day, which is the opening convocation, this opening ceremony for the university. Charter Day is actually the founding the ceremony that celebrates the founding of the university. And so that happens in every March. So they took it over. She asked Bill Cosby to leave the stage because we had business to handle. And then she explained to everybody that was there, she said, "The university exists for the students, not the other way around. This is step A. And we're not stopping until Atwater is off the board." But the university still did not relent. The next day, after a tense meeting, the students knew that something else had to be done. Weeks earlier, someone had stolen the floor plans of the administration building. So they knew what their next target would be. They bought locks and chains and appeared Monday morning at the building opened. The campus police executed a sick out, which was probably in solidarity with the students. By 9:30 a.m., they were in control of the building, and the staff happily conceded. The upper administration was absent, which is kind of a metaphor, right? They later filed an injunction ordering the students to leave, but the students remained. The next morning, the students were confronted by the Metro Police, and then a battle ensued. But the students refused to bend to the will of the police. They were, quote, "too black, too strong," which became a motto of the protests. So when Atwater saw the images broadcast nationally, because one of the things that they did, they sent Raz outside to go talk to people, and Raz brought all this media attention, including national news. This was broadcast on CBS National News, NBC, New York Times, Center Team, it was literally national and even international news, which probably helped save their lives because as the police were taking over the building, it was being broadcast. So when Atwater saw these images, he tries to save face, and so he resigns. The students won, but it was not a complete victory. So they remained in the building an additional day to ensure that everyone knew that Atwater was the spark, but their issues with the university actually ran deeper. So they left the building in the early morning hours of March 9th, 1989, but they kept fighting. They took over student government. They brought hip-hop, the language of their resistance, to the university and beyond. They made educational transformation their bellwether. They fought the police, and then they sought control through electoral politics. Their HBCU experience was fundamentally shaped by the protests, which fundamentally shaped their lives. It seems that all our lives we've had to fight. These two sisters right here, Zenobia Wright, who's in the middle, and to her right, Cherie Warren, two leaders of the protest today. They are principals of schools in the Bronx. And this is just one small example, which is a big example of how people who were made conscious by this protest sought to change the conditions. So they brought a particular consciousness to their work, and they continue to bring a particular consciousness to their work as educators. There's an even greater influence in the musical traditions, which is kind of funny. Here's a funny story. This is a poster being sold in the Hilltop, which is the campus newspaper. Students United will never be defeated. I think the third from the right, that is actually Sean Combs, known as Puff at that point. And what's funny about the story, as we talk about how people were shaped by this particular protest, Sean was the person that was selling posters with his photo immediately after the protests, because he became, at that moment, essentially someone who wanted to make money out of these particular images, right? And so his claim is that as an entertainer, as a hip-hop insider, Howard shapes his worldview. And this is, I guess, is an interesting example of that. He not only sold these posters, he also sold t-shirts saying that I survived the Howard protest. But it's funny, but it's also important because, as you can see, he's on the roof. And when the police came, that was one of their routes of entry. They landed helicopters on the roof. So he was directly in the line of the danger. And they literally had to hold off those police from entering the building. And so Sean was obviously, or he obviously became someone who was extremely famous and wealthy. But in that moment, he was just like every other of these students who took a risk. I think there may be a lesson in that too. In closing his comments at Fisk, Du Bois asked, quote, how far and in what way can we consciously and scientifically guide our future so as to ensure our physical survival, our spiritual freedom, and our social growth? Either we do this or we die. There is no alternative. He then wound to an ending, as I will end, by saying, quote, we are not dead yet, and we are not going to die. So let us then be insane with courage. Thank you.
But it really doesn't matter with me now. Because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He has allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
Away, packed my bags, headed for Greyhound. It was a Monday. Time to start my mission. I felt that burning feeling in my soul. I had to listen. I had this reoccurring dream from the stage in a suit with a fade. I had set the game ablaze and they threw me a parade. I stacked a little change and took my family out the caves. But I was trapped in the maze like a lab rat. And at the bottom of the barrel where they keep the crabs at. No Geico, no Aflac, nothing to fall back on. But the streets where it's cussed out the police and so they crack on. Better known as back home, where they treat the Arabs and the Spanish and the blacks wrong. There he go with that song. You may be tired, but I spit what I'm inspired from the Lord of the worlds, cause the devil is a liar.
They say, I've seen the lightning flashing,
yes, I did.
And I've seen the thunder roar, but you can't.
You can't keep me down for long,
cause I'm getting stronger.
Cause I keep getting strong.
Like a shot of Jack Daniels, a baby grand piano, lighting a Hopkins, smoking cigs, strumming on the banjo. The son of man's a son of a gun with hella ammo. A sheriff shooting Bob Marley, John J. Rambo. Six sextillion, 19 million. The holy pyramid say we all are lost children. Voodoo for the pilgrims who bring weapons and conceal them. They silence you with force and then indoctrinate your children. Yo Gabba Gabba, Ahmadina Jabba, blow up your apartment if you don't observe the Sabbath. I look the devil in his eyes, say abracadabra. Then drown him in the mighty light his brain couldn't fathom. Scrapping every day, just like Fight Club. A thriller and a smooth criminal like Mike was.
Say, say, I've seen the lightning flashing.
Yes, I did.
And I've seen the thunder roar, but you can't.
You can't keep me down for long.
Oh, yeah, oh, yeah.
That's it for Africa World Now Project for this week. I would like to thank you for joining us today and look forward to spending time with you next week. We can be reached through all your regular social media platforms. Email africaworldnowproject@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter at AFWRLDNWPRJ. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. The Africa World Now Project Collective consists of international media journalist, executive producer, and human rights activist, Moise Mutale, Africa World Now Project media correspondent, Funda Ngunda, senior research, content contributor, and production director, Dr. Tasneem Siddiqui, senior researcher and content contributor and production associate, Dr. Josh Myers, associate producer and content contributor, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, technology advisor is Byron Gray of GrayWorks Technology, and creative director is Judah Pope. Africa World Now Project is heard every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WSNC, NPR affiliate and broadcasting service of Winston-Salem State University. Shows are archived weekly on SoundCloud. Search Africa World Now Project. Until next week, be safe, be peaceful, and above all, be intelligent.
The commitment to revolution, to the complete overthrow of savage oppression and the spectrum of ignorant or disingenuous evil reaction, is also a commitment to work and study. It is a commitment to organization and mass expression. Where are our revolutionary journals, the newspapers, the magazines? Where are our revolutionary movie houses and galleries and theaters? Instead, we hear snoring or the fashionable cynicism of the loyal opposition. It is the self-determination and self-respect and self-defense of life and its revolutionary movement that the poets must concern themselves with as intimately as their own personal lives. It is form as well as content, essence, science, and vision. Art must be our magic weapon to create and recreate the world and ourselves as part of it.